Hi, my name is Sejal Parikh, and I'm your host today. Welcome back to our podcast, Precision Bites, talking with patients about weight management. This podcast is made up of a series of simulated clinical encounters dealing with motivational interviewing and weight management in different social contexts. Today, the provider will be talking with Mrs. Johnson, a 45-year-old white woman with chronic hypertension. She's presenting for follow-up after her annual labs showed mild transaminitis, hyperlipidemia, and a normal HbA1c. Her provider followed up by ordering an abdominal ultrasound, which showed increased hepatic echogenicity consistent with fatty liver disease. She'll be diagnosed with hyperlipidemia and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease in this visit. Of note, Mrs. Johnson is a sole income earner. She supports her husband and two school-aged children. She works two jobs since her husband lost his job in the 2008 recession. He hasn't been able to find stable work since. Things we want you to take away from this episode include 1. How food insecurity, hunger, and weight interact, and 2. Diet strategies for the resource-poor and busy patient. Hope you enjoy. Part 1. Missing the bus and catching the liver.
Come in.
Hi, Mrs. Johnson. How are you doing today?
Hi, Doc. A little flustered. I'm sorry I'm late. The bus was late and I missed my other bus and it was just all a big mess.
Oh, no. I'm sorry to hear that. I hope it wasn't too much trouble, but I'm really glad you came in today.
Well, you left a pretty cryptic message about my results. Mm. I didn't feel like I had a choice. You know I had to miss work to come here?
I know. I know it's another trip back here, and I'm sorry about that. You know that I wouldn't have called you back unless I thought it was important for you, right?
I know, but Doc, you've just had me running around so much lately. Last month I came here for my annual appointment, and then I had to go back for my fasting labs, and then I had to go get that weird sonogram of my belly. And it's not like I'm pregnant or anything. And now I'm back here again. You know, I've had to cancel my shift 3 times because of all of this.
I'm really sorry, Mrs. Johnson. Really, I am. I want you to know that I think of your situation every time I order a test. I was waiting to see what the blood test showed before I ordered the sonogram, because I know you have a high deductible insurance plan, and I didn't want you to get hit with a big bill if it wasn't necessary. I didn't want to order things that we didn't need, you know?
Yeah, but I'm just worried about my job.
I know. And I'm sorry for the hassle. How about I write you a note for today and the last couple of times you had the test? Would that help?
Not really, but I guess it's worth a shot.
Okay, well, we'll get that for you in case it does help. All right, Mrs. Johnson, I called you back here because I wanted to go over the test results with you.
Yeah, let's hear it. Finally.
Okay, well, before we get started, let me tell you why I ordered these. Mm-hmm. So, over the past 5 years, your weight has been increasing slowly. Initially, your labs were okay, but recently your cholesterol has been getting higher.
Okay. So I have high cholesterol? I can just take a pill for that, right?
Yes, your cholesterol is high, but because of your high blood pressure, weight gain, and high cholesterol, I just wanted to check your liver function, too.
What? What's wrong with my liver? I don't drink any alcohol at all.
When patients who don't drink alcohol have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and weight gain, there can be increased fat deposition in the liver. This is called fatty liver disease.
Now I have liver disease?
Well, I want you to know that this is treatable. All your symptoms, lab tests, and liver ultrasound are consistent with fatty liver disease. I'm not worried about something scary happening right now, but we do need to come up with a good plan to treat this.
Doc, I just need a moment.
Oh. Mrs. Johnson, it's going to be okay. We're going to come up with a plan. You're going to be okay. Okay. You're going to be all right, Mrs. Johnson. You will. Here's a tissue.
I'm sorry about that. It's just been such a roller coaster these last couple years.
I know. It sounds like it's been a lot.
Well, yeah, first my husband lost his job in the recession. Then I went back to work. Then you diagnosed me with high blood pressure. Then we had to foreclose on the house. I thought we were barely keeping it together. And now this.
I know. It has been a lot. And it seems like that stress has affected your body with the high blood pressure and the cholesterol and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But Mrs. J, I don't want this to feel catastrophic. Yes, we do need a solid plan, but it is treatable.
Okay. What do you think we should do?
Well, there are two major ways to treat this. Diet and medication. For my end, I can write you a prescription for a medication called atorvastatin that you can take once a day. This will help lower your cholesterol. It's really important to know that the only way to really fix this, though, is to change the diet.
Just more to worry about.
Pearl 1, missing the bus and catching the liver. Opening this encounter requires tackling two main issues. One, the patient's frustration with frequent appointments, and two, the new diagnosis of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So first of all, Mrs. Johnson is pretty upfront with her frustration about the frequent appointments. Her situation is complicated by the reliance on public transportation and a busy work schedule. While Mrs. Johnson has been great about making it to her appointments and tests, not all patients in her situation would be. A recent study examined more than 25 million primary care appointments at the VA hospitals and clinics. This study found, on average, that the no-show rate for female young adults was 35% and for male young adults, 40%. This no-show rate decreases about 2.4% on average with each additional year of age. So this begs the question, how do we decrease the no-show rate for primary care outpatient appointments? A gigantic British meta-analysis of more than 460 studies about appointment reminders was published in 2014. This meta-analysis estimated that between 3 and 17% of patients did not show up to appointments because they genuinely forgot. Simple appointment reminders decreased the no-show rate anywhere between 10 and 15%. Manual follow-up calls were slightly more effective than automated reminders. In this interaction, the provider had called Mrs. Johnson with, albeit vague, test results, which stressed the importance of the follow-up appointment. The second main issue in this part of the encounter is the new diagnosis of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. I'll be calling it fatty liver disease for short. Fatty liver disease is the most common liver disease in Western industrialized countries, with ultrasound proven prevalence in the U.S. of about 20%. The pathogenesis of fatty liver disease is not entirely clear, but it is thought of as hepatic steatosis without evidence of significant inflammation. Common risk factors for fatty liver disease are type 2 diabetes, central obesity, dyslipidemia, and metabolic syndrome. As rates of obesity increase, so do rates of fatty liver disease. It is most commonly diagnosed in patients in their 40s and 50s. To diagnose fatty liver disease, the provider needs to show evidence of 1. Hepatic steatosis on imaging or biopsy, 2. Exclude significant alcohol consumption, and 3. Exclude other causes of hepatic steatosis. So what labs and imaging results are you likely to see with fatty liver disease? Typically, you should see higher than normal AST, ALT, and ALK-FOS, sometimes 2 times the upper normal limit. The AST-ALT ratio is classically less than 1. If you're worried about fatty liver disease in your patient, remember to order a hepatitis panel, plasma ferritin, plasma iron, and screening autoimmune labs to rule out autoimmune hepatitis. Part 2, understanding patient fears and perceived barriers.
Okay, Mrs. Johnson, I see you're overwhelmed. I know what I said sounded like a big deal. What's the one thing that's worrying you the most about this fatty liver disease?
Well, it just sounds bad. Mm-hmm. I had no idea this was going on. I mean, liver disease? Don't people die from that?
Oh, but Mrs. Johnson, we diagnosed it pretty early because you're so on top of it and you always come in for your annual exam. We can treat this type of liver disease. Some of my patients have it, and we've been able to come up with a good plan for them. They're doing well.
And it just means I have to do so much to fight this.
What do you mean?
Well, you said I have to diet and everything. I barely have time to say goodnight to my kids between two jobs. How am I going to cook gourmet meals every day?
So you're worried that having a different diet is really time-consuming?
Yes, and expensive. I can barely make rent. How on earth am I going to be able to shop at Whole Foods?
Okay, so you're worried that these changes will be time-consuming and expensive.
Yeah.
Okay, I get it. The prices at stores like Whole Foods scare me. But for a minute, just go along with me. Are there any upsides to changing the diet?
Doc, I know I could eat better, but it's just so hard.
I know. I hear you. That's why I wanted to talk about the upside of changing your diet. Sometimes to make these hard behavior changes, it's helpful to have some positive motivation. Like, how will this help me? What else will I get to do if I make this change, etc.? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I guess I don't want to pass this on to my kids.
Yeah. And we know that a better diet can prevent diseases like fatty liver.
And I guess I do want to lose the extra weight anyways.
Yeah, and for your health, I think that would be good.
I guess with summer coming, it could be nice to fit into some of my old dresses again.
Yeah, absolutely. So changing your diet will be hard because you think it can take time and be expensive. But some good reasons to change your diet are because you want to make sure your kids are healthy, because you want to lose some weight anyways, and you have some clothes you'd like to fit into again.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Okay. Mrs. Johnson, thank you for sharing all of that with me. I know this is a lot of information, and I just want you to know that I do think we can come up with a good plan.
Thanks, Doc.
Pearl 2, understanding patient fears and perceived barriers. When patients are newly diagnosed with a chronic medical issue, they can get angry, sad, or shut down. Mrs. Johnson's reaction of being overwhelmed is pretty common. One strategy to support the overwhelmed patient includes stop introducing new information unless necessary. When patients become emotional, it can be helpful to introduce some structure. We recommend first prioritizing the patient's fears. You can ask questions like, "What are you most afraid of?" or "What's the one thing that's upsetting you the most?" Don't expect crystal clarity in your patient's answers. They're trying to work it out in the moment. Allow for pauses. They probably don't feel as long to the patient as they do to the provider. Second, try to assess the patient's perceived barriers to getting better. In this encounter, the provider asks Mrs. Johnson why she thinks eating differently will be hard. Mrs. Johnson targets time and cost, and the provider repeats these barriers back so that he and the patient are on the same page. When patients get overwhelmed to the point that they don't feel efficacious, step back. Engage in motivational interviewing. Eliciting reasons why change is good from the patient is often more meaningful than the provider giving the patient a list of reasons to change. On the other end of the spectrum, sometimes providers back off weight management too much when patients are overwhelmed with a variety of medical issues. And understandably, a couple extra pounds won't kill you with the same speed of untreated AFib or even a bad asthma attack. However, it is important to make time at some point to talk about weight management. One study in 2016 showed that patients who lived at the poverty line were only half as likely to receive weight counseling as compared to patients who lived at 400% of the federal poverty line, when both groups had the same BMI. Of course, we want you to be sensitive to the needs and bandwidth of the patient, but this is a reminder to not kick the weight can too far down the road. Part 3, Diet History.
All right, Mrs. Johnson, before we get to making changes, I just want to understand what you're eating now. So let's start with this. Where do you eat most of your meals? At home, at work, or...
Well, I usually have some cereal in the car on the way to work for breakfast. Mm-hmm. I have lunch at work, and then I usually pick up dinner for everyone and head home for dinner. But, you know, sometimes I go out with my friends, and sometimes I just rush home to make some mac and cheese.
Where do you usually pick up dinner?
Well, I'm not proud of it, but usually McDonald's or Jack in the Box or something like that.
Okay, sure. What do you usually drink with dinner?
Diet soda. I know it doesn't have any sugar and it has a nice taste. Plus, the caffeine really helps when I get home to the kids.
Okay, and what do you usually snack on between meals?
Usually chips or whatever is in the vending machine at work, really. Yesterday was a coworker's birthday, so I think there were donuts and cake. Actually, was there cake? I don't quite remember.
Okay, Mrs. Johnson, do you feel like you and your family have enough food?
Well, we've been on food stamps since my husband lost his job in the recession.
I'm sorry to hear that times have been pretty rough. Do you find yourself not having enough food for everyone at the end of the month?
No, nothing like that.
Do you have the type of food that you want?
What do you mean?
The foods you and your family eat for lunch and dinner, are those the foods that you would eat if money was not a factor?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we all eat, and we eat well. Maybe I would want something different. I don't know. But this is the way it is right now, so.
What types of foods would you want more if money were not an issue?
Maybe I'd want more fresh fruit for the kids at home.
Okay, sure. So I know I'm jumping back, but what do you usually get for dinner when you go to McDonald's?
Well, it has to be the drive-thru because I don't have time to actually go in. I guess it would be the adult meal for me and my husband. I think it comes with a big burger, fries, soda, and a happy meal for the kids. Sometimes I get a salad. I don't know how often, though.
Okay, so Mrs. Johnson, I know before you said you were worried about the price of changing your diet. Mm-hmm. I think the adult meals at McDonald's are around $5.50 and the kids' Happy Meals are around $3.50, right?
Yeah, so?
So, two adult meals, three kids' meals, that's about $20 for dinner, right?
Yeah. Doc, where are you going with this?
I just don't want you to think that all this healthy food has to be expensive. For example, if you were to make a homemade soup for part of dinner, let's say with chicken stock, tomato paste, rice, celery, carrots, you know how much that would cost you?
Yeah, but I don't have time to be doing any of that, Doc.
Mrs. Johnson, it would cost you $5 to make that soup for your whole family. For the amount you would need, the chicken stock, tomato paste, celery, and carrots would cost you about a dollar each. I know because I make it for mine. Just think about, even if you made a $10 chicken dish for everyone, you would still save $5 a day on dinner. That's an extra $150 you have at the end of the month.
Wow. But, Doc, I don't know if my family will go for that. I mean, my kids are in second and third grade, and they're pretty picky. Plus, my husband, he's pretty used to the food we have.
Yeah, it's hard when the whole family is used to a certain diet. And I don't want to make your life harder by forcing everyone to eat healthy. Mm-hmm. But let's start with the kids. I want to let you know that we have some really good research that shows the more young kids are exposed to vegetables, even if it's stuff like cooked spinach, the more they are going to like and eat them.
Yeah, but Doc, that's over months, right? That doesn't really sound doable.
Yeah, that's a fair point. So here are some strategies that I like to give my picky eaters. One, start with fruit. We can try to use fruits as a gateway to vegetables. Since fruits are sweet, kids are more likely to like them. An easy thing to do is to have a packet of frozen berries in the freezer and use that for dessert instead of other frozen treats. Second, start mixing in vegetables into their normal foods. So if you're planning on ordering pizza for dinner, get some bell pepper and onion toppings in addition
but
to pepperoni.
Doc, I know my kids. They'll just pick off anything they don't like and make faces.
Okay, and I just want you to know that that's most kids' reactions. That's normal. Our goal is to increase their exposure without forcing them to eat anything. So start mixing in veggies into pizza, pasta, whatever your kids like. Yeah, they'll pick out things and make faces, but eventually your kids will start eating more vegetables.
I mean, I'll think about it.
So in that vein, I have one more thought. Include your kids in basic food preparation. Let's say you're steaming some frozen vegetables to take to work for lunch the next day. Have your kids help with washing and separating the vegetables. The more they see and touch vegetables, the less foreign they will seem.
Doc, do you really think that will work?
Well, it's a start. These three strategies have worked for many of my patients. I don't want to overload you with changes today, so let's start with these three things, and then we can check back in and see how it's going.
Pearl 3, Diet History. This is a good place to talk about the poverty-obesity paradox. The poverty-obesity paradox is that we expect patients in poverty to not be able to buy enough food and therefore have low BMIs. Instead, what we see is that patients from lower socioeconomic backgrounds tend to have higher BMIs. So what theories are out there to explain this paradox? Well, when we look at global trends over time, we notice a little more nuance. As incomes in developing countries rise, so do rates of obesity. But when people transition from lower to middle or upper class, rates of obesity fall. Moreover, during times of economic crisis in Cuba and the Soviet Union, the BMI of lower class people fell. So, there seems to be this sweet spot where people are poor enough to be food insecure, but not so poor that they're consistently hungry and losing weight. We also know that NHANES 3 data shows, in women, food insecurity without hunger is associated with being overweight. But wait, what's the difference between food insecurity and hunger? The USDA defines food insecurity as limited or uncertain availability of nutritionally adequate and safe foods, or limited or uncertain ability to acquire acceptable foods in a socially acceptable way. Sadly, the USDA does not officially track hunger, but it uses the definition of potential consequences of food insecurity that, because of prolonged involuntary lack of food, results in discomfort, illness, weakness, or pain that goes beyond the usual uneasy sensation. So, back to the poverty-obesity paradox. Why are food insecure patients who do not experience hunger heavier? Cheap foods seem to be the key. More academically speaking, the energy density hypothesis states that energy-dense foods are cheaper per calorie, and therefore poorer patients are more likely to buy these energy-dense foods. Energy-dense foods, such as chips, are usually cheaper because they have a longer shelf life and are easier to transport. But if people are eating more energy-dense food, doesn't that just mean they'll be full quicker? Unfortunately, no, it doesn't. Satiety is in part psychological and has more to do with mass and volume of food than necessarily caloric intake. So you might be wondering, why do I care? What does the provider need to be able to take away from this? Well, the provider needs to be able to differentiate between hunger and food insecurity to risk stratify the patient. How do you do that? We recommend asking the following questions. 1. Do you and your family have enough food? And 2. Do you and your family have enough of the foods that you want to eat? Food insecure patients may claim that they have enough food, but it may not be the type of food they would want if money was not a factor. Another strategy is to ask about specific behaviors associated with food insecurity. For example, skipping meals, cutting meal size, or eating less than one should are all behaviors associated with food insecurity. Finally, it's important to assess what social services this patient is already taking advantage of. Popular meal assistance programs include WIC, free and reduced price lunch and breakfast for school-aged children, SNAP food stamps or EBT credits, and Meals on Wheels. Many farmers markets even give extra value for SNAP dollars, sometimes up to twice as much in tokens that patients can use at the markets. Part 4, Making Changes.
Doc, that soup stuff is news to me. I'm still not sure my kids will go for it, but I guess I could still make it for myself. But Doc, I'm sure that takes time, and I don't have time to go grocery shopping every day.
No, I understand. No one does. But that's the beauty of this. You don't have to go grocery shopping every day. You don't have to eat only organic local produce. You don't have to spend a lot of money on eating well. I don't want you to think that eating well requires this huge life change.
Yeah, but Doc, what do I do?
So I like to recommend a couple of things. One, I'm a huge advocate of frozen vegetables. Of course, fresh vegetables are better, but I would much, much rather you have frozen vegetables than none at all. Canned vegetables are okay, but you have to make sure to get the low-sodium cans. Otherwise, they have way too much salt in them. And to be honest, I would rather you eat a non-organic frozen carrots than no carrots. I don't think the organic thing makes a big enough difference for you to not eat non-organic vegetables.
Really? You don't think that organic matters?
No. I would rather you eat more non-organic fruits and vegetables than fewer organic fruits and vegetables.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. And two, I recommend for busy moms like you to get a slow cooker or crock pot. The basic ones at Walmart are $20. The reason I recommend them is because you just put in the ingredients, frozen vegetables, whatever, in the crock pot in the morning, set it for a couple of hours, and ta-da! You have a warm soup ready for you when you come home. And you can add meat or lentils to make it more hearty. And it's pretty safe. It turns itself off. You don't have to worry about burning the house down or your kids hurting themselves or anything.
Oh, that would be so nice.
I recommend it so highly because I use it for myself. I just toss in some vegetable stock, frozen vegetables from Walmart or Costco, anything in bulk, really, because it's cheaper. and so then I add some canned beans, some salt and pepper, and then come back home to a nice soup. It's just so convenient.
I think I saw on Facebook or something that people make roasted potatoes and other things in the slow cooker, too.
Yeah, exactly. It's not just soups at all. I think slow cookers are great because they can get around the time issue. You don't have to be there standing in front of it making sure it doesn't spill or burn. Okay, so number two is slow cookers.
Okay, that sounds good.
The last thing I'd like to talk about, exercise. What do you do for exercise right now?
Well, you know, it's hard. The neighborhood we're in now, I can't really go jogging at night after work. I mean, it's not like I would have the energy to do that anyways, but still. And there's no way I could afford a fancy gym membership, even if I do save that $150 a month from homemade dinners.
No, makes sense. I want you to be safe. So the third thing I recommend is using some exercise apps. Here, let me show you on my phone. So there are some free apps that are nice, and you can do super short workouts, like 7 to 10 minutes. Here, see this app? It's called Fitness Blender, where you can follow along all these fitness videos, and you can choose how long you want to work out for. Mm-hmm. You can just put a towel down on the floor. It doesn't need to be a fancy yoga mat or anything, and follow the video. Isn't that neat?
Yeah. Yeah, and 10 minutes sounds reasonable. But, Doc, I heard that you need to exercise an hour a day to lose weight. I definitely don't have time for that. Can I really lose weight on only 10 minutes a day?
I'm glad you brought that up. To be completely honest, you will not rapidly lose weight based on these three recommendations. I counsel a lot of my patients in weight management, and I've seen the most successful patients be slow and steady. They don't try to change everything at once. They try to make changes that fit into their life, like the crock pot or these 10-minute workouts or something. And they do that well for a month and add something else, like controlling portion size and cutting out sodas and juice. And then they do that well for a month. And then they think about other changes. Does that make sense? Then their changes are just so much more sustainable.
Pearl 4, making a plan. Before we get started with specifics, we wanted to take a step back and talk generally about giving advice. With each recommendation you make, the patient decides how in touch with her circumstances you are. Making a limited number of recommendations that you know well and that are appropriate for the patient's circumstances will increase the patient's trust in you. So the first thing that the provider recommended was frozen vegetables. For a moment, zoom out to the big picture with me. The research on food science is vast, and to be honest, incredibly intimidating. We've all had patients ask us about niche food science things, and I personally have had little more to offer than a shrug and a sympathetic nod. After enough of these experiences, I decided to learn the basics. When presented with a food science question, I find it helpful to categorize the question in one of two groups. The first decision we make is macronutrient versus micronutrient. Macronutrients generally contribute to energy. This is fats, carbohydrates, and proteins. Almost all foods have some mix of these three. It's important to emphasize that carbs in and of themselves aren't bad. Healthy people generally need a balanced intake. I also like to give a special mention to fiber here, particularly important for your constipated patients. So those are macronutrients. We know that macronutrients can positively and negatively affect chronic diseases, such as diabetes and heart disease. In the next category, micronutrients, I focus on vitamins and minerals. Within vitamins, I like to separate fat-soluble vitamins, water-soluble vitamins, and other organic compounds like phytochemicals and polyphenols. Any more divisions, and personally, I get lost in the weeds. So remember those three categories: fat-soluble vitamins, water-soluble vitamins, and other organic compounds. We'll come back to them when we talk about food preparation. Foods that have vitamin A and E, the fat-soluble vitamins, are carrots, sweet potatoes, and dark leafy vegetables like kale. Most processed grains have added vitamin B, so you don't need to worry about that. Foods that have vitamin C, the water-soluble vitamin, are bell peppers, citrus fruits, and dark leafy vegetables. There's been considerable research about vitamins for certain disease processes, like vitamin E for Alzheimer's disease. No vitamin treatment has been a silver bullet for disease, so the medical community is mainly watching and waiting to see what happens with ongoing research. In the meantime, emphasize to your patients the benefits of eating a variety of different colored vegetables. Okay, so to recap, when thinking about food research, the first question is it a macronutrient, like sugar, starch, protein, or fiber? Or is it a micronutrient? And if it's a micronutrient, is this a fat-soluble vitamin, like vitamin A and E, a water-soluble vitamin, like vitamin B and C, or another organic compound, like polyphenols? So that was a quick and dirty way to think of food science. Now let's zoom back into our encounter with Mrs. Johnson and talk about frozen vegetables. When vegetables are frozen, the sugars, starches, fibers, or all the macronutrients in the food are preserved to close to the same levels as fresh vegetables. However, when vegetables are processed, water-soluble vitamins such as vitamin B and C do take a significant hit. Processing includes freezing, canning, cooking, really anything. That being said, fat-soluble vitamins such as vitamin A and E don't take as big of a hit with food processing. Know that there is much active debate about these topics. And it's fair to say that fresh organic local produce likely has many benefits that science has yet to discover. That being said, Mrs. Johnson is choosing between fewer fresh vegetables and more frozen vegetables due to her financial constraints. Looking through the lens of her fatty liver disease, Mrs. Johnson would likely benefit more from the increased intake of fiber and complex carbs in frozen vegetables as compared to the extra beta carotene in a fewer number of fresh carrots. It is important to know that the scientific jury is still out on many of these topics, so the provider does have to make a judgment call on recommendations. Think about your recommendations in context of the patient's financial means and other health issues. We feel comfortable recommending frozen vegetables to Mrs. Johnson, despite the loss of water-soluble vitamin C. Part 5, conclusion.
Sure, all of that makes sense. But doesn't that take a long time? How much trouble am I in with this whole fatty liver thing?
Sure. So weight loss is actually the treatment for fatty liver disease. Hmm. The best evidence suggests that our target weight loss should be about 1 pound a week. Oof. I think that can be intimidating to think about as a deadline, so I do think we should try to make these changes and then see what happens. There are more intensive exercise programs and nutrition groups I could recommend if we're not seeing close to a 4 pound weight loss in a month. What do you think?
Yeah, I probably won't have time to do more than what we talked about. So how about we stick with this plan for now?
Sure. That sounds good to me. Let's check in a month and see how things are going.
Sure, Doc.
Okay. Just so we're on the same page, could you tell me what changes we're making in the next month?
Yeah, well, you're writing me for another medication, a tour something.
Mm-hmm.
And then I will buy frozen vegetables to have more veggies in my diet. I'll go buy a crock pot. And I think I forgot one.
Yeah, and we talked about the exercise app.
Oh, yeah.
7 to 10 minutes every day. I will give you the prescription for the medication, atorvastatin. It should be fine with the blood pressure pill you're taking, and I don't anticipate any major side effects. Let me know if you experience any muscle cramping.
Mm-hmm.
1 tablet a day. And here are some crockpot recipes that we recommend for our patients. And we'll see you back in a month. At that time, we'll do another weight check, talk about how these changes are going, and then talk about portion sizes and soda.
Okay. Thanks, Doc.
Okay. I just want to remind you that we don't expect to see changes in a week. This is the first step in a process. We have to start with small changes and work up to bigger changes. You are on the right path.
Thanks.
Of course. Have a nice day, Mrs. Johnson. Say hi to the family for me.
Okay, sure.
Pearl 5, conclusion. Just like always, it's important to be on the same page as the patient about upcoming changes. At the end of the visit, the provider asks Mrs. Johnson to repeat back the changes she's going to make. She lists that she will, 1, use more frozen vegetables, 2, buy a slow cooker, and 3, download an exercise app and exercise for 7 to 10 minutes a day. When introducing these small changes, be sure to emphasize the stepwise process and manage expectations of weight loss. To get Mrs. Johnson's buy-in for the next appointment, it's helpful to mention the upcoming agenda items. In this encounter, the provider mentions that the upcoming topics include portion size and soda consumption. By cutting down 1 can of non-diet soda a day, patients can avoid gaining 1 pound a month. Cutting back on soda is a particularly relevant intervention for the resource poor. In fact, sweetened beverages were the second most common thing bought with food stamps in 2016. Finally, while we want more face time with patients with chronic diseases, this particular patient's burdens are financial. If they're open to coming back in, that's great. Otherwise, offer phone or email check-ins to save your patients the copayment and lost income of coming back. Well, I hope that felt realistic and was helpful for you. Let's recap some of the key points from this podcast. 1, in the introduction, if you're worried about a patient no-showing, give them a call a couple days before their appointment. Remember that fatty liver disease is very common in the Western world, and the treatment is often weight loss. 2, when understanding the patient perspective, it can be helpful to ask the patient to identify the one thing they're most scared of or upset about. While patients often have a laundry list of acute medical and social needs, remember to also treat weight as a medical issue. 3, when taking the diet history, remember to ask questions about food insecurity and hunger. Also, remember to assess which social services the patient is already using. 4, when introducing changes, remember to give a few recommendations that you know well and that are sensitive to the patient's social context. When thinking about food science, separate macronutrients from micronutrients. Water-soluble vitamins are affected by food processing, but fat-soluble vitamins and macronutrients are not. And finally, in the closing, get buy-in and set the agenda for a follow-up appointment. Thanks for listening. See you next time. This podcast was made possible by the support of the Area Health Education Centers of California, the California Public Health Training Center, the Western Region Public Health Training Center, and the Medical Scholars Fellowship by Stanford University School of Medicine. Thanks to Dr. Michelle Hauser for her feedback. Special thanks to Virginia Fox for her support and advice. Thanks to Leah Slang and James Seifert for their superb acting.